Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. When New Horizons launched at Cape Canaveral in 2006, it was set to fly by a planet. But that same year, Pluto was demoted to the status of dwarf planet, largely because of one man. His name is Mike Brown, and he joins us today. Mike, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Okay, so you're probably very sick of it by now, but let's get it out of the way. You are a Pluto killer.
Oh, it's true. I mean, really, what I am is someone who made some discoveries that eventually led to the reclassification of Pluto, but that's a little longer to say.
You don't like to be called a Pluto killer.
I actually call myself that.
It's a nickname. So why did you do it?
What really happened is that when Pluto was discovered back in 1930, people had no idea how big or small it was. I was just looking at the New York Times headline from the day of discovery, and it said that Pluto might be as large as Jupiter, and that's only wrong by a factor of something like 10,000. But in 1930, they didn't know how big it was. They didn't know anything else out there, so they called it a planet. And it's been this mistake that was perpetuated for all these years that really, now that we know so much more about the outer solar system, we finally cleaned up that mistake.
All right. Well, let's look at the photos or talk about the photos for a second. How excited were you to see the first images of Pluto, to meet this planet that you sort of demoted?
It's been a fun, slow build. So I've been watching daily over the last couple of weeks as the spacecraft got closer and closer. And, you know, you could first kind of barely make out these smudgy features that didn't mean much. And even just last week, you could, you know, there were features there, but I just couldn't really tell anything. And then suddenly, bam, you get these images with, you know, the big icy heart on it. You get these giant ice moons. It's just fantastic to watch it come through.
Yeah, the photo that caught my attention also was that icy heart and the close-up of the surface. It looks like this weathered face with mountains etched onto it. Does it remind you of anything you've seen in outer space before?
You know, it parts of Pluto look a lot like parts of a lot of different places. It doesn't look like any one place, but all the parts are sort of familiar. We've seen big icy cliffs and mountains on a lot of the moons of the outer planets. We've seen these really smooth plains that look like they're maybe frozen nitrogen, frozen methane. We've seen those on Neptune's very large moon, Triton. So all of them are a little bit familiar, but put together in a way that seems unique and a little bit unfamiliar.
And I saw that there's been many, many guesses about this mysterious world billions of miles away. Like you said, it was really just this speck. And there were ideas that it might have mountains and valleys or liquid water or frozen methane lakes. Now that New Horizons has taken these photos, what can we say?
Well, you know, the fun part about it, as someone who has been studying Pluto from a telescope for decades now, many of the ideas that we had about what Pluto was going to be like are right. We actually do a pretty good job of understanding these bodies even before we get there. But we didn't know the details, and so it's the details that are sort of the interesting ones that we're still digesting from all these pictures that are coming in today.
How about the color? What did we know, or what did you guess about the color, and was that correct?
So the color is actually one that's one of the easiest things to measure from telescopes here on the ground. So the color has been well known for decades now. I still in my head. You know, I knew the color. I could make a plot of what the color was, and yet still in my head, I thought it was going to be a little redder, a little more spectacular than I find it a very sort of drab, washed out beige. Saying, "Oh, look how beautiful it is," and I think, "Wow, it's actually less pretty than I thought it would have been."
Not a new paint chip color that's
yeah,
going to take
seems
off.
Yeah, unlikely.
Yeah. And how do you detect the color? Is that through wavelengths of some sort or chemicals?
Yeah, so it's the color, we simply point a telescope at Pluto, and it's the same way that your color camera works, essentially. You put in three different filters in front of your telescope, and you measure the brightness of Pluto in those three filters. And then, you know, if it's red, it comes out more in the red filter. If it's blue, it comes out more in the blue filter. And that's how we get all of our digital colors these days.
Now, 20 years ago, Hubble snapped some images of Pluto. But even that telescope's impressive eyesight barely reveals what the sphere is. Why? I thought that Hubble could get us pictures of galaxies billions of miles away,
away. So Hubble can see almost forever, and it can see these galaxies just on the edge of the universe. But these galaxies on the edge of the universe, though far away, are huge. So you even in these pictures of galaxies, you're not seeing individual stars, much less things as small as Pluto. So Pluto is just in the scale of how big it is on the sky, it's smaller by a factor of 10 or 20 than most of these galaxies that people have been looking at.
So how did the project to explore Pluto with this spacecraft called New Horizons actually get started?
Oh, it had been going on for even as early as the 60s. People had talked about trying to get a spacecraft to Pluto. And of course, back in the 60s, Pluto was considered the legitimate ninth planet of the solar system. So it was one that people really wanted to explore. There was a mission called the Grand Tour that was going to go Jupiter, Saturn. You couldn't get to Uranus and Neptune if you were going to go to Pluto. So one was going to go Jupiter, Saturn, Pluto. One was going to go Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Those missions became the Voyager missions that really did do Jupiter, Saturn, and Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. But by the time they occurred, Pluto was not in the right place to get to. So the idea of exploring Pluto lay dormant for many years. But people still wanted to go. And so it took a group of very dedicated scientists to keep pushing the idea over and over again, and it kept on sort of bubbling up into the idea of something NASA could do, and then it would get swatted down again, then it bubbled up, got swatted down. So it's hard to even remember how many different potential spacecraft there were until finally New Horizons got on the books and got launched. But it was a long, long process.
And this spacecraft, New Horizons, I keep hearing it described as this gold or silver foil-wrapped baby grand piano, which is great, but who's seen a gold-foiled baby grand piano? I mean, can you think of anything else that it might look like that we've seen, most people have seen?
We don't tend to see gold-foiled anything of that size. But we do see baby grand pianos. So ignore the gold foil wrapping part and just think of it as a baby grand piano out there with a few telescopes sticking out from it.
And that size, so I was trying to look up the dimensions. It seems like it's a little bit smaller than one of those smart cars, sort of.
Yeah, that's about right.
Something like that.
You know, so think of it as a gold foiled smart car.
Okay, that's good. And it's also the fastest spacecraft ever launched. Is that right?
Yeah, so it launched from the Earth the fastest that any spacecraft has ever gone. Actually, as it is right now, it's not the fastest anymore because other spacecraft, the Voyager spacecraft, launched from the Earth slower, but they went by Jupiter and Saturn and got a big boost of speed. And so they're now faster than New Horizons is. But when it launched, it was the fastest that anything had been going.
Now, Pluto's long been a mystery, Mike. Before Clyde Tombaugh found it, as you said, in 1930, it was known as Planet X. So talk about how Tombaugh finally discovered Pluto.
Yeah, so this is an interesting historical story. So I wouldn't say that Pluto was Planet X. What was
going on? Or they were searching,
They were searching for Planet X, and astronomers were convinced that there was a planet out beyond Neptune because they thought they saw Neptune getting tugged a little bit out of its orbit in a way that it shouldn't be doing unless there was a giant planet out there. So astronomers set out looking for this Planet X and found Pluto. And that's one of the reasons why astronomers were so wrong about how big Pluto was, because they found this thing and they said, oh, it must be the object that's pulling Neptune out of its orbit. Turns out we now know that Neptune is going exactly where it's supposed to be going, and those early data were just bad. So there's nothing pulling Neptune out of its orbit. There's no need for Planet X out there. But Pluto was found, assumed to be Planet X, and so that's one of the reasons it was clearly, at the time, seemed to be a planet.
And it was such a discovery. And there's an interview with Clyde Tombaugh in 1991, and he describes the pleasure that he got from searching the skies.
I have this feeling of a wanderer. I like to kind of look there and to sweep around through the Milky Way and say, oh, there's hundreds and hundreds of stars and star clusters. It gives me a feeling of great elation. It's a therapy for me. Just idle, plowing through the sky, you know. It's fun. And wonder what all the wonderful things that must be going on there that we don't see. Realizing there are thousands and thousands, millions of alien civilizations out there doing things, maybe something like we are. This is something you think about.
So he passed away in 1997 when he was 90. But some of his ashes are on the New Horizons spacecraft, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing thing. So they flew by Pluto, and they'll be the first human ashes to leave the solar system.
Wow. Can you relate to that feeling that he describes when you're searching? Because you that's what you do. You search for planets.
I have followed in Clyde Tombaugh's footsteps very closely, except my job, I feel like, is a lot easier than his was. He sat at the telescope night after night. In the daytime, he would develop these photographic plates, and then in the afternoons, he would look at them by eye. And I do all the same things. I use the telescopes. I use now digital cameras, and I look at them to see what moves. But it's all done with computers and robotic telescopes. And so it doesn't quite have the romance of sitting out in that telescope dome watching the sky overhead. But I still get that feeling. You know, you're still by eye pouring through many, many images of what's in the night sky. And, you know, you'll be looking for these things that are moving that are in the solar system, and particularly pretty galaxy will catch your eye. And it's hard not to just stop and stare at them for just a split second and think about all those same things that Tombaugh was talking about.
That sounds so amazing. I love the story of how Pluto also got its name from a young girl. Is that...
Yeah,
right.
So when it was discovered, there were many people. People were very excited. People sent telegrams to the Lowell Observatory where it was discovered of congratulations, and there were many people suggesting different names. But a young girl from England looked at the mythology and said, you know, Pluto would be an appropriate name for this very cold, very distant world, naming it for the god of the underworld. And it was such a great name that they sent it by telegram. Her father sent the telegram to Lowell Observatory, and I don't know how, if they just opened it up and said, oh yeah, that's the great idea, or if it took him a while to do it, but that was eventually the one that was accepted.
It's funny that Pluto was named after this god of the god of the underworld, because it went on to be a sort of an underdog in the planetary system, and people love to root for the underdog, which we definitely see with Pluto.
It's definitely true. And I mean, as a kid, I had a poster of the solar system on my wall, and you know, all the planets are in these great circular orbits going around the sun, and then there was this distant Pluto whose orbit was so weirdly elongated that it didn't even fit onto the poster, so I had to imagine it going out onto the street where it would have been. And who would not love that? In this poster, it had icy spires on the surface. So I still look at these pictures. I'm looking forward to the higher resolution ones that are about to come in, and I'm going to look for those icy spires that I've been thinking about since I was, you know, a school kid.
We're going to take a short break from Think. In a minute, we'll be back and talk about the very entertaining Pluto memes making their way onto Facebook and Twitter. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. You can join our conversation. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from astronomer Mike Brown after this.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. I'm talking with astronomer Mike Brown. He's author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. The Pluto images have already become memes. There's Miley Cyrus sitting on the swinging dwarf planet like a wrecking ball. Also, Donald Trump's face superimposed on the rocky surface. Mike, do you have a favorite that you've seen going around?
I love the just Pluto with the big heart and wrapping his arms around itself. I mean, as soon as those images, those first images showing that heart-shaped region came in, how could you not think about that? And how could you not get sort of a warm feeling yourself for this big icy thing with a heart on it?
So what's up with that heart shape there? What is that?
Oh, so that's a great question. And to me, that's one of the more mysterious things that these first images have shown so far. You know, we've known for decades that the equator of Pluto should be generally dark. And it is. Those dark bands that the images have shown are mostly along the equator. And yet, right at the center of the equator is this big, bright, icy heart where it should be warm. All the ices should have evaporated and moved somewhere else. I think that it's a region that is currently evaporating, and that heart, I'm sorry to say, I think the heart will disappear and be replaced by dark material, which sounds kind of sad, but I'm not sure. We need
coronary
to see more images to really,
or something.
Darkness spreads. It's sad. But we need to see those images, really the up-close images of the edges of the heart, will really start to tell us if that idea is right or if there's something else entirely going on. And we just don't know yet.
Do we know what Pluto's atmosphere is made of?
We do. It's the atmosphere is basically the ices that are on the surface that evaporate and go into the atmosphere. So the surface is mostly composed of nitrogen ice, and so the atmosphere is mostly nitrogen, like the Earth's atmosphere, only on Pluto it's a million times less dense. And there are trace amounts of methane gas and carbon monoxide, which are the other main ice components on the surface.
Now, how did we know what Pluto's atmosphere was made of if we'd never been close to it?
Yeah, so astronomers have all sorts of tricks that they use to figure out what's going on a body, even when you can't get up close to it. And so one of the ways you figure out what's in the atmosphere is you wait for Pluto, which is moving across the sky. Just by chance, it goes right in front of a star. And this actually happened just a couple of weeks ago. It happens all the time. As Pluto goes in front of the star, you analyze that starlight that is now going through the atmosphere of Pluto before it then disappears as Pluto totally blocks the starlight. And from analyzing that starlight, you can learn things like what the atmosphere is made out of, what the temperature of the atmosphere is, the size of Pluto. All these things we knew very well before we even sent a spacecraft there.
And if Earth has an average temperature of, I think it's around 60 degrees Fahrenheit, what is Pluto's? How's it compare?
Pluto's, you're gonna make it hard on me by having to convert it to Fahrenheit.
Oh, so, but I'm gonna tell you can you can say Celsius. That's all.
I forget what it is in Fahrenheit, but the typical surface temperature on Pluto is about 40 degrees Kelvin, and 0 degrees Kelvin is absolute zero on the centigrade
scale.
I see
something like -400 degrees Fahrenheit, something very cold.
That sounds about right. It's not a particularly warm place. And yet those temperatures are the temperatures at which you can start to evaporate ices like the nitrogen ices and turn them into the gases.
What would happen if Pluto was brought closer to our sun, if Pluto was one of the planets nearby?
It wouldn't be, because it wouldn't last. It's mostly made out of this nitrogen, or the surface is all this nitrogen and methane and carbon monoxide. All of that would quickly evaporate to space. It would basically just become a big comet evaporating into space. Now, eventually, there might be a rocky core that's left over, and that rocky core would be kind of the size of typical asteroids in the asteroid belt. So it's good that it's where it is because it wouldn't last anywhere else.
Huh. Now, what is the relationship between Pluto and the one moon? I think we've seen only photos of the one moon, Charon, right?
Right.
So is that relationship like ours to our Earth to our moon?
It's very similar in many ways. It's similar both in how they behave with respect to each other, but also where they both came from. We think that our moon came when a sort of Mars-sized body hit the Earth and that material spun off the Earth and formed the moon. And we think that on Pluto and Charon, the same thing mostly happened. A large body hit Pluto and that spun off and became Charon. So they're similar from their origins, but also they are similar. You know, the moon, our moon, always points one face directly at the Earth, so we never see more than one face. On Pluto, it does it one better. Charon always points one face at Pluto, but Pluto always points one face back. So they're actually locked, almost like a dumbbell rotating there in space.
So is there a dark side of Charon then, just like there's a dark side of the moon?
There's a far side of Charon, like there's a far side of the moon. And both on our moon and on Charon, of course, those are dark when the sun's not up, but they're quite bright when the sun's up.
And what could we learn from the other moons that Pluto has? Is their origin story similar to that of Charon?
We think that their origin story is, in fact, exactly the same as Charon, that they came at the same time. This impact that happened that made Charon also spewed out a little bit extra material that didn't make it into Charon, and that's the tiny moons. It's got four tiny, tiny moons that we're not going to get a very good look at those. They're just going to look like sort of irregular blobs, but that's presumably where those came from.
You can call and join our conversation. If you have questions about Pluto or you have comments about some of the photos that we've seen so far from the New Horizons mission, you can call 800-933-5372. You can also send an email to think@kera.org. Now, what else can we learn from the photos that we've got so far from Pluto?
There's some really interesting stuff actually on the moon Charon. So far, I am more blown away by the image of Charon than I am by Pluto. And it's just because Pluto, we just need more images of Pluto to really start to understand what's going on. But we have a very nice global view of Charon. And it was released yesterday. I sat there. I clicked on it just like everybody else looking online to see the image. And my jaw dropped. The first comment that came out of my mouth was, where are all the craters? I expected Charon to look a lot like our own moon as a sort of just pockmarked surface. And it's not. Now, the analogy with our own moon is not a bad one because our moon is pockmarked with craters except in the regions where there were these big volcanic flows, the mare, the dark parts on the moon, and these big volcanic flows covered up the ancient craters, and you only have a small number of newer craters on them, even though this happened 4 billion years ago. On Charon, it looks like the same thing happened, though instead of volcanic flows, rocky volcanoes, magma, it was ice. Water ice would have flown on the surface of Charon and then refrozen into its rock form. It's basically a rock in the outer solar system, and erased all those craters. And you can see these cracks where the ice would have, the water would have come out of. You can see the plains where it flowed. It's just an astounding image to look at.
Huh, that's interesting. Some of the photos I've seen of the moon, I couldn't quite figure out what was going on. So it's nice to have someone who can actually interpret it.
If you're looking at those right now or going back and looking at them, look at that crack. There's a crack on sort of the bottom third that goes all the way across the moon, and then below that crack, south of that crack, it's very smooth. Look at those regions where it looks like water that flowed across and then refroze and no new craters. And even within that smooth region, if you look carefully, you can see where the water probably flowed around a slightly higher elevation and preserved the old terrains in there. Same sorts of things you see on Hawaii, where you look at the lava flows, and then there's a little hill that sticks out that didn't get inundated by the flow.
If you've got questions about the photos, maybe you're looking at them right now, call 800-933-5372, and that's where we find Ben, who's in Dallas. Ben, you there?
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Great.
Thanks for having me. My question's kind of broad, but it involves what is the main purpose for our exploration as far as Pluto, just because it seems to be an expensive venture. And what do we have to gain from these kind of trips that we take out there?
Good question.
You know, people like to give answers to questions like that, like, oh, you know, we're going to learn about the origin of the solar system, or, you know, we're going to invent Tang and so we can all drink Tang, or something. I have a slightly different take on it. And my take is that the point of exploration like this is exploration. We as a human species are explorers. You know, we've done it since we could walk across the jungles where we lived. We've sailed across the oceans on the Earth, and this is the exploration that we're currently doing. It's more expensive than walking across the jungles, but it's as a 15-year project. You know, it's a cup of coffee for a day for each American, and it's overall a relatively cheap thing to continue that exploration that I think is so critical just to the human spirit.
Hmm. Now, Shahid also in Irving has a question. Shahid?
Hi.
Hey there. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is more about the mission itself. So I'm always intrigued to find out, how does your mission going out to these far distant planets basically do not avoid getting hit by any other celestial objects like small asteroids or any rocks around, things like that? Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a great question. So it's, you know, we've all watched Star Wars and you know, and know that as you fly through the asteroid belt, you have to dodge asteroids left and right because you're always about to get destroyed. But the Hollywood version of the asteroid belt and the solar system is not anything like reality. In the solar system, if you want to try to visit an asteroid on your way to flying to, say, Jupiter or beyond Jupiter, you have to try really hard. You sit around and calculate every asteroid orbit and say, well, maybe if we tweak the spacecraft just a little bit, we can get a little close to this one and take a few images. The space is essentially empty. So the probability of getting hit by any kind of tiny asteroid that could do damage is essentially zero most of the time. And I say most of the time because the one worry was that there might actually be debris left over right around Pluto that was left over from this giant impact that we were talking about earlier, and that it could have been that the spacecraft got destroyed right as it flew past Pluto. So this is why a couple of nights ago, everybody was excited to get that first little carrier signal back from New Horizons that said it made it past Pluto okay. It had all the data on its memory stick, and we'll be getting those data back over the many, many months to come.
Do you think that memory stick looks like the kind of memory stick I put in my laptop?
I hope it's not one of those that you just plug in, because, you know, those don't seem to last quite as long. So I'm hoping it's a little bit better than that.
Yeah, I would too. We refer to it as if it were all the same technology, but I'm guessing it has to be prepared. Also, can they prepare it to withstand tiny bits of debris or microscopic elements?
Yeah, it's not the debris that's the main worry. It's actually radiation. So you're out there in space, no longer protected by the Earth's magnetic field. So it's cosmic rays, it's particles coming in, and those things happen all the time. And there has to be redundancies in the computer. If the computer gets a little glitch because it got hit by a piece of radiation, you know, it has to know to not do certain things, or to be able to be smart enough to turn itself off and reboot itself. So there's a lot of autonomy that has to happen on a spacecraft this far away.
Especially because communicating with the spacecraft is not exactly like picking up the phone and sending a message.
Yeah, so it's both far away, so the communication, the data rates are slower than your dial-up of 15 years ago. And it takes a long time just to get light out there, get a radio signal out there, is something like 6 hours one way, 6 hours back. So if you would like to talk to it and say, hey, what just happened? Then you wait 6 hours, and then you wait six more hours, and it says, oh, I did this. And then you say, oh, well, don't do that. Do this. You know, you're looking at 18, 20-hour delays, and that's too long. You might have done something wrong. So it has to be smart enough to not need that continuous human interaction.
Do you think that any of the photos taken by New Horizons are going to pull on people's heartstrings enough to to bring more protests out to demand that Pluto be reclassified?
Oh, sure. How can you not see that one with the heart on it and think, oh, I love this and it should be a planet? And I understand that nostalgia. It's the people. It's not kids these days. People always say, think about the kids, but it's not the kids. It's thinking about your own memory of when you were a kid and you learned that Pluto was a planet and you loved it. And now that they're feeling all that love again. But it's important for everybody to remember that it does not have to be a planet to be interesting and scientifically important and worth exploring. And to me, the fact that it's so interesting of a body that we're seeing and not a planet shows you that there's so much more in the solar system beyond the planets that we need to keep exploring.
It's like saying, I don't know, Pop-Tarts aren't a breakfast food or something.
Well, that part might be true.
Or Special K is no longer a cereal, I guess. People just they like their labels a lot. Do you find yourself having to convince people still? I know you used to get hate mail about this.
Yeah, so the hate mail has all died down because all the people who sent mail are now on Twitter. So I get tweets instead. Yes, I do, and it's not hard to convince someone. Usually, the people who are most adamant that Pluto should still be a planet are the people who know the least about the solar system and what's really out there. And if you can sit down with people and show them how Pluto actually fits in the context of the rest of the solar system and how the eight planets are huge and dominant in the solar system, and there are thousands and thousands of bodies that just sort of flit around in and out of the giant planets, people will eventually understand, but it's hard to talk to every single person on the planet, so it's slow going.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. For the rest of the hour, we're talking about Pluto, its ice mountains and canyons, and mysteriously heart-shaped region. Helping guide us is astronomer Mike Brown. He's author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Call in with questions. The number is 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll be back with more after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
It's been an incredible voyage, the first to visit Pluto and to fly on beyond into the Kuiper Belt. This is true exploration. I'm so glad you're all here to participate in it. That view is just the first of many, many rewards that the team will get, especially since Pluto didn't turn out to be a relatively featureless planet with a nitrogen-foggy atmosphere, and we're scratching our heads, you know, thinking, okay, what are we going to do with that? Pluto has turned out to be an extraordinarily complex and interesting world.
I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. That was NASA's John Grunsfeld reflecting on the Pluto flyby completed this week. Today, I'm talking with planetary astronomer Mike Brown. Mike, Pluto exists in this enormous neighborhood called the Kuiper Belt. What is it?
So beyond the orbit of Neptune, there are thousands and thousands of objects that are small, little chunks left over from the origin of the solar system. And they would have liked to have all gotten together and coalesced into one big planet. But as they started to do that 4.5 billion years ago, Neptune formed too fast and shook everything up, and they never got a chance to get together to form a planet.
Sad.
It is
a little
sad.
Bit sad. So what happens now? This is the biggest question I think everyone wants to know with the spacecraft.
So it's going to spend the next 18 months staring back at the Earth and sending that data, trickling that data back. So it's we've only gotten just the very thinnest slice of everything there is to see so far. So 18 months it does that, and it continues on in a straight line as it does that. But when it's all done, there is an opportunity to visit another body. Now, New Horizons is traveling so fast, and it has so little fuel left right now that it can't make a very big turn to go to a new body. So basically, instead of saying, okay, let's visit this body that we knew about, we instead had to go find something that was basically right along the path where New Horizons is going. And it looks like there's one or two objects. They're small, small objects in the Kuiper Belt, maybe 20 miles across. And New Horizons may be able to get close enough to those to start to get some pictures of those.
Hmm. Now they have to decide which ones they want to go to? They want to focus on.
Yeah, it looks like there are only two good choices these days. There was a big search for many different ones. There was the hope that maybe there would be a lot of choices or even multiple ones to get to. But it looks like it's one of two. And so those decisions will be made in the next couple of months of which one the New Horizons team would like to go to. And then NASA has to make a decision about whether they will continue the funding for New Horizons to go do that, because the official mission of New Horizons is now over, other than sending the data back. So this would be an extended mission, a new task for New Horizons to do. And it has to NASA has to decide if it's important enough to spend the money to keep it going.
If you've got questions, you can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Mike, there are a few artifacts that were sent away with the New Horizons spacecraft a decade ago was when it launched, including one I saw as a U.S. stamp from 1991 proclaiming Pluto not yet explored. Do you know what else is on there?
You know, there are things that they probably haven't even told everybody yet. So I knew about the Tombaugh ashes, and I knew about the stamp. I don't know what else is on there. I'm sure that they will slowly reveal with time what else is in there.
I saw one thing that caught my eye, something about a CD-ROM on the probe, which has something like 430,000 names on it from some Send Your Name to Pluto outreach.
Yeah, so it's... In the Voyager days, you know, we sent these beautiful sort of images of what humans were like, and figured out ways that we could send this information in a way that you might be able to decode it if somebody found the Voyager spacecraft 100 million years from now around another star. CD-ROM is a little tough. I suspect that even we couldn't read that CD-ROM right now.
I definitely couldn't in the office. I'd have to go somewhere special. So yeah. The data that New Horizons is sending back, it's a massive amount of data. Who's going to have access to it?
So the way that all of NASA missions work is that as a reward for working so hard and getting this mission there, that the New Horizons team gets first crack at it. So for something like 9 months, they have exclusive rights to look at the data, to write the scientific papers, to make the first discoveries. And that's I am happy that they have that chance, because they are the ones who really deserve to do that. But I'm also happy that after 9 months, the data are completely publicly released to anybody in the world who can then look at them and make their own interpretations. And often the real hard science that comes out of these missions comes from that longer-term analysis. The team usually only has time to make some very quick preliminary findings, and then it's up to the rest of the community to find all the other interesting stuff in there.
So they'll go back into their office and sort of shut down. The moment of in the sun was the countdown and these photos.
That's right.
And it's a lot of work from there, which is what you spend a lot of time doing, right?
Yeah, so it's the same sort of thing happens with me. I as an astronomer, I take these images of the sky, I analyze them, and my images too. After a certain amount of time, they go completely publicly available, so anybody else can go and look at what I've been looking at and make their own analyses of them.
Call and join the conversation, 800-933-5372, which is where we find David in Dallas. Hey, David, you there?
I am. So you actually already answered my first question. So a quick follow-up question. You mentioned water flowing out of a crack on that southern portion. And I'm just curious, since it's so cold there, how is it that water can flow.
Oh, so it's an exact analogy with a magma flow on the Earth. You could say the same thing. It's so cold on Earth. How can it possibly be that rock would flow from a volcano on the Earth? And the answer is, it doesn't do it for very long. So on Charon, underneath the surface, and this was in the past, I don't think it's happening now, but underneath the surface on Charon, there would have been an ocean, and there would be cracks, and that when that crack opened up, water from the ocean would have flown onto the surface and flowed for just a little bit of a distance before it froze out, just like magma does on the Earth.
Hmm. You mentioned, Mike, that this data becomes available eventually to lots of people. So there's a question here. Venkat in Dallas is curious about what happens with that data after that.
It all goes to something called the Planetary Data System. So all NASA data from every mission that ever happened, although some of the early missions were on punch cards and ticker tape, and so they're a little hard to read. But every mission that's ever happened, the data are archived on this thing called the Planetary Data System. Anybody can find it if you just do a web search for that name, and all the data are there. It's actually a pretty amazing thing to sort through, Voyager images of Jupiter that no one's ever seen before or no one's ever published before because there's so much data still there to be seen.
Let's take a call from Venkat in Dallas. Venkat?
Yes. Thank you so much for taking my question. It's a fascinating show. Thank you, sir. The question I had was, with so much of automation on these spacecraft, what is the type of programming languages that you use?
Programming language.
Yeah, programming languages are, that's actually is a really good question. And I don't actually know the answer for New Horizons specifically. But for the most part, these are, they're still constrained by wanting to pack as much as they can into a limited amount of memory. So they're all very low level languages that are being written to do all this. So it's not done in Python. It's not done in Basic. It's done in some lower level stuff.
Huh, that's fascinating to think about. You want it to be also universal enough where people can understand it and interpret it later on, so not something too obscure.
Well, the programming languages on the spacecraft itself, nobody needs to interpret it later. The data that come back are in some very standard formats. And so those are in formats that are easily readable to anybody with any kind of image processing software. But how it gets there, that's a little more complicated.
I guess they don't want anyone to know the programming language in that sense.
Right.
You don't want to hack the spacecraft. Were there concerns about that?
You know, to hack the spacecraft, you would first have to hack the NASA Deep Space Network so you could talk to the spacecraft. Now that I say that, I think, wow, maybe that's not that hard to do. So I don't think there are any concerns about it actually happening, but maybe we should start worrying about these things in the future.
Let's go to Gregory in Dallas. Or I'm sorry, John, is that John in Grand Prairie?
Yes.
Hi there, what's your question?
My question is whether a lot of the geological activity that we see on Pluto isn't the result of water as much as other elements acting as water does here on Earth, such as methane and elements that we see here as gas, but under the extreme cold become liquids and then act like water does here on Earth, and actually where water might actually be like stone on Pluto.
Yeah, so you have it almost exactly right. So if you talk about water ice on Pluto, you're essentially talking about rock. At those temperatures, water is a rock. And so the things that act like water are exactly as you said, nitrogen ice, methane ice, carbon monoxide ice. But the one thing that doesn't happen is that they never turn liquid. The pressures are not high enough to maintain liquid, so they sublime. They go directly from their ice phase to their gas phase and into the atmosphere. That's still enough to cause all of this sort of activity. There's a lot of the stuff that I read in the last day that talks about Pluto being geologically active. I wouldn't call it geologically active. I would say the surface has frosts moving around on it in an active way. That's not quite the same thing as saying that right now Pluto has eruptions of something on the surface. So I think your picture is exactly the right picture.
Now, do the measurements taken from New Horizons tell us the exact size of Pluto?
They do. This was a big moment for me on Monday when the new size was announced because, of course, I am the discoverer of Eris, the one that we know is more massive than Pluto. But it's been a question for a while which one is actually bigger because within the uncertainties, they were exactly the same size. And it's been hard to measure Pluto's size exactly right. And so it could have gone either way. Turns out Pluto's bigger. I'm a little sad. It doesn't actually matter one way or the other, but I still would have enjoyed it if the thing that I had found had been the biggest thing that we knew about out there. It's still quite a bit more massive than Pluto. If you took Pluto and added all of the asteroids between Mars and Jupiter, you would get the mass of Eris, the one that I found, but it's all packed into a slightly smaller package. Slightly smaller means 20 kilometers out of a 2,000 kilometer diameter. So they're almost exactly the same.
Now, you've said that scientists care more about mass than size. What do you mean?
Well, it's the body. What is in the body, you can tell by the mass of the body. And, you know, you can make things a little bigger and a little smaller by slightly warming them up or slightly cooling them down or putting a little bit of extra porosity inside one. So we often talk about when we're talking about the planets and their and how they behave, we often use as a shorthand we talk about compressing them. If you took all this material and compressed it down to the smallest ball possible, how that would be. And so Pluto is made out of a lot more ice, which is easily compressible than Eris is. So its compressed size would be a lot smaller. But in the end, they're basically the same size, but the mass on Eris is a lot larger. And that's telling us that they're very different bodies on the inside, which is fascinating. I would have guessed that they were nearly identical twins, and they are superficially twins, but on the inside, very different beasts.
And Eris, do you have hopes that there will eventually be a mission to get photos of that?
You know, Eris, I would love it someday to see that happen, but Eris is three times further away than Pluto, and Pluto itself was pretty hard to get to in a reasonable amount of time, if you think a decade is reasonable. 30 years is a long time to wait. I hope it happens someday. I'm not going to hold my breath on that one.
There's not enough fuel left in New Horizons to reach that far.
Well, you could get that far, except New Horizons would also have to make a U-turn because Eris happens to be on the opposite side of the solar system.
Well, what else would you like to see the spacecraft explore? We just have a little bit of time.
Well, we don't have options. So there's one or two objects that it happens to be going right towards, and so I'm excited about those one or two objects. It's a great way to look at a great mission to look at one of the biggest objects out there, and then look at some of the small ones too, and tell you what the range of things are like in this new region that we're exploring of the Kuiper Belt.
Mike Brown is professor of astronomy at the California Institute of Technology, and of course, he's author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Mike, thanks again for being with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Knecht is associate producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman. Thanks for listening to Think This Week. Chris Boyd will be back on Monday.